the label is an integral part of the key parts of what I nominate as my contribution. When I had that breakthrough, I was thinking in terms of connections and interconnections to the traditional area of focus, which is as a painter and someone who comes from and acknowledges a tradition of painting and museums and display and so forth. I'm thinking about the object of the wall and how it is presented. But as time went on, and because I was looking at, once I had invoked the presence of the viewer and the strings that support the suspended painting, the equivalent of the strings to the viewer is the floor they stand on. So bit by bit, I would come out and realise that each piece was connected to another piece and each was necessary without the whole thing collapsing. And so as, in a sense, the artwork embraced both image and the world, of which image is a part of, I started to consider more, you know, to consider aspects about the walls, aspect about the rooms, and aspects of how the work is described, who has the right to describe my work. And it seemed to me that convention in museums had it that the artists had the right to title their work. And even the word title after a while intrigued me. We talk about certain people receiving titles and entitlements and so forth. So slowly I became more and more aware of our language use. In my case, specifically thinking about that in its application to how we describe a work of art. So it's the titles have gone over quite a long journey, and the label itself, which includes the title, has gone over an even longer journey, and sometimes with very small refinements that have been quite critical. I'll just talk briefly about the title that I've arrived on. It's most titles will be something like a sentence or a phrase, or they may even be called untitled. And particularly, so I was aware in the early 70s, many artists, perhaps coming from intellectual and studied backgrounds, were in the same way as they'd emptied content out of their canvases, had emptied content out of their titles, so they would formally title their works untitled. That was an option I considered and did use in variations for a little while, such as Untitled Painting Number One and so forth. So that's a mix of those thoughts after a while. Well, when it had settled down after perhaps 10 years, I had a three-line title followed by a meta title, something that commented on the first three. So the first line of my standard title is with a lowercase d at the start is the word detail. So when someone who might look at my paintings of paintings that include viewers of viewers and look across to see what the title says, the first line is detail. And I think in some senses that's the such a simple word, but its implications are so large. So the way I intend it is the thought that whatever we think this work is, which the imagery seems to say includes us and seems to include a self-aware object hanging on a wall, this is only a detail. It is part of something larger. And the question then is, what is larger or what is included? So the second line begins to indicate some aspects of the detail of what so far is a limitless possibility, a detail of what. So The second line is, a person looks at a work of art. And then there's a blank stroke at the end to give another alternative, because I'm allowing for some people who may say, because they have a sense of what a work of art is and what a work of art isn't, they might say, that's not a work of art. In which case, I've simplified further in the third line. So the third line is, someone looks at something. So you can see there the language is very low-key. It's kind of generalised, but it also it sufficiently reflects the moment and the situation that someone reading that line will find themselves in. Then there's something like a meta-title, which has some complexity, but it can be quite simply understood as well. It's a word that has an oblique stroke between two parts. So the first word is logos, spelled L-O-G-O-S, and then there's an oblique stroke, and then there's ha-ha as two words. Just briefly about the word logos, it's a word we all use every day, or we reference it in all the studies and divisions that have the suffix ology at the end. So biology, zoology, theology, etc., are all referring to this word logos. It comes from the ancient Greek philosophers, and my definition of it, one that I heard once, is the speaking into being of the universe. So it's how the word becomes flesh. The word being the sound that's in the air emitted by us by some intention and result within and from the body. We say the word, if I make the sound chair and I call that now a word, we've all somehow in our mind, we're kind of visualising a chair, but probably no two of those chairs are anything like the same. And this is the logos. It's the speaking into being of the world. And that speaking comes from our mouth, and it comes from our mind. It comes from intention to, we're trained in order, and that order is that there is a subject who makes an action which relates to an object or causes an object to come into being. So if I say I look at a work of art, we have the subject is I, the looking at is the speaking into being of the work of art. So this is subject, verb, object, full stop, subject, verb, this subject, this object. So this is coming from a hole at one end of the body. It's making a sound. What is making a sound? A mind and an intention is making a sound. But sometimes we make various slips, or there are pauses or stutters, or we say the wrong word and we apologise and so forth. So that perfect speaking into being of the world doesn't usually happen. And at the same time, at the other end of the body, which others have described as a bag, this Zen monk poetry might refer to this bag of wind. From the other end comes ungovernable sounds such as burps and farts and all the rest. So we are... this is recognising the body that is beholding the world into being, or beholding a painting into being, and deciding that that painting can move into a higher category of art, or a slightly lower category of bad art or exceptional art. So with each of these decisions, this is the mind to some extent recognising itself and trying to shape its own surroundings through what's called the logos, but recognising its frailties and its imperfections as well. So if the Logos is an attempt at perfect speaking into being, then the ha-ha is disruptive, and laughter can represent both joy and anger and confusion. So it's another word representation of something which agitates the Logos. I have a print by Noel Coonahan, a Melbourne Australian artist from 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s into 70s. In the early 70s at Australia Galleries in Melbourne, I saw an exhibition of his, and the key aspect of that, and he was a communist. He, as far as I know, he was not a religious person, but this is one of my very famous, favourite religious reference works. He did a series to do with the laughing Christ, and Christ as the Word of God is another version of the Logos spoken into being. There's a whole series of Christ with his crown of thorns on and obviously laughing. And in my own case, with a Catholic background, strong Catholic background, and used to the image of the crucified Christ, the sacrificial lamb, that's another image of Christ. To see an image of Christ laughing is similarly disrupting, and perhaps it's almost my key reference for the ha-ha, because it's the Logos that's laughing. We start to get into some cross-cultural complexity, but this is where it becomes playful and rich at the same time. My label serves two purposes. One is a critique of museum labels as I find them, and that critique is from my position, which includes the viewer. So often a museum label, again referring to artworks and so forth, might say oil, and oil could be, we cook with oil, but they're not referring to that. So already there's a presumption we know what oil is. It's paint. They could say paint, and sometimes they say paint, and then they say on canvas. But that, to me, always seems very, very poor description of anything. And I decided that since the title of the work included the viewer, and included the act of looking, and included the object that was being seen, that merely to say oil and canvas was again denying the embrace which I've brought forward of the viewer. So of necessity, I have to say that, well, I've talked a little bit about the role of the mind and the active person constructing the world in front of them. So for me, the mind is something, the medium rather, is something like consciousness. I've just taken the standard categories of the museums, which often include title as one of the things that they name and nominate and name. And I've included medium because they usually like to refer to some of the materials that are used. So these are conventions, and these conventions look odd to me. Consequently, that's why I say the medium is a person looks at a work of art, as well as being the subject matter, that is also the medium. Someone looks at something, and cultural consumption production is kind of a phrase from the late 70s, early 80s. But what it says is this is culture that we are both consuming and producing at the same time, that you, I, the viewer, is not a passive recipient of culture hand down, but we are, as I've already mentioned, we're constructing the world as we go. So we're receiving something which has been offered, but we're receiving it through our own filters. But in so doing, we are recreating. We never receive anything purely, and I've already talked about interconnectedness. So that in a sense, there is no purity. Everything is flowing through everything. Yes, and there are two other aspects There's the title, there's the medium, I give a date, and I always put a little slash, a mark in front of the date that I give, and that that represents before, and then I give the date, perhaps when I made the work, and the second line or slash indicates after. So I'm acknowledging that I, as the nominated creator, am subject to influences of all those artists I've studied who've come before me, and that the viewer who's reading the work and who is part of the work, they continue the work as they live on and pass on their own understanding of the culture. We each make our community culture one by one as we go. And then the fourth is the artist. And I would usually give my own name, but sometimes I might give one of my pseudonyms. Sometimes I stamp my works. Fosterville Institute of Applied and Progressive Cultural Experience, which is, I had a rubber stamp made myself and a friend in the early 70s when just in a moment of lightness when we were attending a seminar with some friends, and at the end of that seminar a paper was passed around so that all those who were representing their institution would sign off and say which institution they represented. And just on the spur of the moment, because we lived in our country place where I was living and working that year was Fosterville, without any forethought, but incredibly fortuitously, because it still seems to apply, Fosterville Institute of Applied and Progressive Cultural Experience. And all those words seem to still apply. Sometimes it seems ironic, and other times it seems quite straight. But the idea of we're applied and we're progressive and it's cultural and it's experience, and we're an institute. We like the idea of transferring our individuality to an institutional, giving ourselves an institutional status with all that might offer us, including deferring responsibilities because there were two of us, to each other, and simply saying, that's not my department, you'll have to speak to so-and-so, because we were no longer individuals when everyone, so early 70s, so many people were desperately trying to be individuals.